Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
And we're live, my friend. Not really live, but we're live. You're not listening to it live.
We're back.
Indeed.
Gloria Gaynor.
Oh, yeah. You doing all right?
I will survive.
You will survive.
Well, I mean, that's Gloria Gaynor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're back from outer space. Same sad look upon your face.
Indeed.
You should play some disco for Congress.
Right before key votes.
I mean, disco and cannabis.
Oh, boy. Can you imagine?
Help some votes.
It could. Or not. Or
guys,
just...
Hold on, guys. Let's talk.
Hey, guys.
No. Don't stop yelling.
Wait.
Shh.
Was there a
vote later on, man?
Do we have a deadline? Where's the...
They already voted?
Oh.
Shit.
Well, I mean, either way, cannabis or just partisanship punts the ball down the road.
Oh.
Well, anyway, welcome back. As always, if you like what you hear on this podcast, go to modstate.com, where you find all of our op-ed and opinion pieces, as well on the left bar, the links to the podcast. If you're on your mobile device, scroll all the way down to the bottom. You'll find the links to the podcast and on both the mobile site and on the website on your home computer, laptop, desktop, whatever you want to call it.
We are safe for work.
Yes, we are. We are not NSFW. We are suitable for work. You can log on.
There's every now and then some satirical descriptions that give way to some, you know, caustic language at times.
Yeah, but
there's never anything vulgar.
No.
You know, we're not like Slate where we're using the C word.
Yeah, very true.
That was a bit much.
You will find our links to our social media accounts below the icon or the... picture on the front of the website, the top of the website, rather. And we appreciate you tuning in and following us. So tonight, on this midweek wrap, this weekend beat, rather.
Are you taking care of patients this week?
I've been taking care of patients all week, man.
Yeah, and you don't know if it's Wednesday or Saturday?
I don't know what day it is. I just show up.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Midweek charting.
We are going to discuss George Freeman's book, The Next 100 Years. And this has been a staple, I think, to the Mod State family, and certainly John and I, and we're certainly not going to go through the entire book, but just discuss a little bit about it.
It's kind of worth bringing up that you introduced this to me in one of our many, while you were a nurse on the Med-Surg Ward of 5 East at Walter Reed, and I was corpsman on 5 Center, which is also a Med-Surg Ward, and you introduced me to The Next Decade by George Freeman in the fall of 2011, and so I ended up finishing it rather quickly. It's not a long read.
No.
And then I went ahead and bought The Next 100 Years and went on to follow Strat for his private intelligence firm on Twitter and whatnot. But anyway, to your interest of full disclosure, you did introduce me to Mr. Freeman and Strat for in these great books, so thank you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's obviously something that needs to be shared. Whether you agree with him or not, or you think he's full of shit, I think the point is there is something to be said about geopolitics and prediction, as every company and every entity is doing some sort of prediction moving forward. But just to introduce George Freeman, would love to interview at some point. So he is the founder of and CEO of Strat4, which is this... company that's a leading private intelligence and forecasting company. And he's done several books, obviously The Next 100 Years, The Next Decade, and then America's Secret War. And
you know, they're very despised by the left. I don't know if you know that or not.
Really? Well, I guess
I'm not going to say the center left, but like the far left. Like, yeah, Mother Jones ran an article on them. That name doesn't tell you all of it.
Yeah.
But, they ran an article, you know, saying that they were an arm of, you know, defense firms, all this, and going, I don't know that that's true.
Yeah.
So much. Hey, if you go back, you remember they had the referendum to secede from Canada? a few years ago. They've done it every
Wait, Quebec, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear that.
Well, so suppose, I thought I would ask you this. So let's say they did secede. What are the odds, probably not very good, but that they adopt the name Quebecistan?
Probably not high.
Would it be great if they did, though?
Quebecistan.
The big middle finger to the West.
Tell you what, I will reach out to my cousins.
You suggest that.
My cousins that live in Montreal, and I will ask about if secession happens, whether or not they'd like to keep Quebec or Quebecistan. I like Quebec.
All right, sorry, I'll be quiet. You go ahead.
All right, so I'd like to just set the stage, because on the last podcast we talked about, just briefly about Europe and post-World War I and World War II. And we did touch on the, you know, financial, or the debt, rather, in this country, and how, look, it's not tangible, but it is something that if it comes to a breaking point, we are defaulting and some other nation's currency becomes more valuable than the United States, what sort of devastation that would cause. So let me just, the opening of this book is, imagine that you were alive in the summer of 1900, living in London, then the capital of the world. Europe ruled the Eastern Hemisphere. There was hardly a place that, if not ruled directly, was not indirectly controlled from a European capital. Europe was at peace and enjoying unprecedented prosperity. Indeed, European interdependence due to trade and investment was so great that serious people were claiming that the war had become impossible, and if not impossible, would end within weeks of beginning. Because global financial markets couldn't withstand the strain, the future seemed fixed. A peaceful, prosperous Europe would rule the world. The next sentence after that is, imagine yourself now in the summer of 1920. Europe has been torn apart by an agonizing war. The continent was in tatters, and the Austro-Hungarian, Russia, Germany, and Ottoman empires were gone. Millions had died in a war that lasted 4 years. So, talk about doom and gloom right off the bat. But the point is, when you, and I think this has sort of shaped how I look at things and the way we do here at Mont State, it's this macro view. And of course, we definitely talk about specifics on this podcast, but it's hard not to talk about specifics, especially domestically, because they are front and center in media and the things that people talk about at the, if they do anymore, the dinner table, proverbial dinner table, and on social media. But I think we fail sometimes to look at macro trends, and we become complacent thinking that the world we live in today, even with its, what's the word? The nuanced ideology,
intricacies,
the ideology you don't agree with, that's so important and that it's so devastating or it's so wonderful, that how little of a role that may play. And there's a couple topics in this book that, you know, he's made these predictions. If you do read the book, he goes almost decade by decade. And I think he ends in, there's 2080, and I think he goes into 2090. I've got to look here again, but I think just 2080 is as far as he gets, which is pretty good for a 250-page book. But some of these topics are as such. So the dawn of the American age, and he paints this picture that the United States really will control and dominate the next 100 years. And I don't disagree with this. I think that there's much that the United States has foundationally in the world that will sort of create this dawn of the American age. It's not as if we have been some sort of champion and leader of the world for hundreds of years. I mean, we're really talking about the emergence of the United States post-World War II.
Yeah, globally, the Korean conflict, which was, it could be so argued, was merely a proxy extension of World War II, that was really the first time, again, outside of World War II, that we were dragged into. Remember, Germany was bombing London daily and we wouldn't get involved.
Yeah.
We got dragged into that, and really, we haven't been involved in international affairs extensively beyond cooperation and intelligence sharing, and of course, fleet building by the French. Mm-hmm. Since, I mean, we've been doing this for 70 years.
Yeah. So, it's interesting when you lay that out. It's not like we've been this dominant superpower for hundreds of years. It really has only been, like you said, diplomatically and leadership-wise and really industrially in the past, 70 years. And so when you see a chapter that's labeled, the dawn of the American age, really in the relative scheme of centuries and how long the humans have been on planet Earth, I mean, it's not like we've been doing that this long. And so there maybe is an argument that, hey, the next 100 years is America's years.
Do you believe that?
I think if you were to... okay, so it's a good question, because I don't think that I should go ahead and predict that America will have the stature that it does for the next 100 years, because you just never know what the hell is going to happen. You don't know. I guess that's what gets people so worried about kind of rhetoric.
Remember, there's a difference in dominion and influence.
True. I think financially, again, though, but you look at this book and it's like, hey, if you're living in London in 1900, you're the financial capital of the world. And that's the way it's going to be. And 20 years later, Europe's the battlefront for the world. And not,
it still is.
yeah.
I mean, it shares it with New York City, but make no mistake, London is still very much a financial center.
Yes, very, very much so. So I do think that America stands financially, and then more importantly, he makes the case for that for this in this book. One thing that will continue America's dominance over the next 100 years, bar some apocalyptic event, the U.S. Navy controls the seven seas, if that's what you call it.
Where 90% of the trade still occurs in the era of Amazon and airplanes. It's hard to believe. We think everything drops down out of the sky. Believe it or not,
no.
Almost 91% of trade, international trade that is, occurs over the high seas.
Exactly. So as long as America continues to dominate and polices and maintains safe transport for trade in the international waters, America continues to dominate. And I think that's the case that
China only has one, and they're working on their second aircraft carrier battle group. We have surpassed our seventh, eighth, and now we're working on our next three.
Yes. And another thing to note as well, when people look to a place like China and they say, look, they can be the next superpower. There's 1.2 billion. We'll never be able to take on that economy of force or mass in the principles of warfare. And I say, well, listen, when you really look at the strength that one nation has because of their naval might, you also have to look at the depth of that naval might. And I think he makes the case, or if he didn't make the case in this book, it's been made subsequently, that the United States has had a naval tradition since, France came over in the Revolutionary War and saved us. So we've had a tradition, a naval tradition, for quite a while. And that tradition, that experience, and that knowledge translates generation to generation. So to start from scratch will take a very, very long time to develop that experience depth.
A lot of people that were arguing about, oh, hey, what about China and all this? Yeah, I get it. Remember, the U.S. was born in blood and bloodshed. It has fought against superior enemies. The United Kingdom, anybody, twice in our first 3 years of existence. And the biggest thing here is, these people are arguing from the position that China could keep up what I and many other economic thinkers maintain was artificially inflated 10% per quarter growth. That's unsustainable. And we've seen it drop tremendously. Okay, their debt has increased massively. Okay, China was not meant to be sustained that way, just like the USSR wasn't.
Yeah, and you're very right about that. So it does make the case here. That complete domination of the world's oceans to further secure U.S. physical safety and guarantees control over the international trading system. So as long as that, the fact that the United States emerged from World War II not only with the world's largest navy, but also with naval bases scattered around the world, changed the way the world worked. He says, as I mentioned previously, any seagoing vessel, commercially or military, from the Persian Gulf to South China Sea to the Caribbean could be monitored by the U.S. Navy. Who could choose to watch it, stop it, or sink it? From the end of World War II onward, the combined weight of all the world's existing fleets was insignificant to compare it to American naval power. So, that highlights the single most important geopolitical fact in the world. The United States controls all the oceans. No other power in history has been able to do this. And that control not only is the foundation of American security, excuse me, but all the foundation of its ability to shape the international system. So, I think with that really be held in mind when you ask the question, well, do you think that it is the dawn of the American age? Certainly, I think there will be a continuance of American dominance just based on basic things like that. I think it's hard to, regardless of the things we talked about in the last podcast about leadership and this and that, nationalism versus taking a stance in the world with leadership. Hold on one second. I got a cough. Excuse me.
While you cough, let me posit this question.
Yeah.
And I just want to see what you think. I of course, am not going to dispute the very Lord Mr. Friedman, strive for, I respect very much, but the way I look at it, and tell me if you think this is fair, is I'm not going to go out on a limb and say that this is the dawn of the American age, because I'm sure that they didn't think as the Visigoths crossed the plains nearing Rome that that was the end of that empire. But looking forward, I would say that the ball is certainly in our court, that it's basically our destiny is within our control, that we're going to decide to what degree we assert ourselves or don't. And remember, many of the founders advocated for isolationism, don't get involved in foreign affairs. George Washington advocated vehemently for that, against interventionism in his closing address. Now, full disclosure, he also advocated against a standing army, because it took England 3 months to get here, whereas it would take an enemy 3 hours to get here.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of those positions would be changed now. But, I mean, do you think it's fair to say that our destiny, our fate, is in our own hands?
I would, excuse me, tend to agree with you. It's interesting to see how policy and views do change based on things like technological advances and, natural resources, et cetera. And something he makes the case for, I believe, in this book, excuse me, there was a talk early in the book where he, obviously when this book was written, you're talking about big contenders like Russia and their vie back to get the Soviet Union again, and places like China. There was the case made, that there would be some sort of alliance, and you'd find this alliance between Russia and Germany in this bid for European dominance, and then, of course, the Soviet Union buildup for Russia again.
But he emphasized that more heavily in the next decade.
He did. You're very right. And it doesn't play, I think, the narrative in this book as much, but I think when you look at geopolitically, what can happen and things that can change quickly. So,
Who saw France going to the epicenter of the global war on terror?
Yes,
and they did in Mali with Operation Serval and going into Afghanistan and Syria.
And in this case, climate change. And so there, you do see these emergences of
you had to do it.
The climate change.
Yeah, you did it. You had to.
I did. But there's, you make the case, like, look, you look at these regional powers and why they will have power. And the case was made that Russia and their vast fossil fuel natural resources will be tapped into and then can be used and leverage in Europe that really doesn't have any of those natural resources. So what are we supposed to do if they can provide cheaper fossil fuels than, let's say, the Middle East and OPEC can do? That is in turn, it's leverage and it's a sign that there could be power there. But then again, it's hard to predict what actually happened here in the United States. And that was a look inward domestically for natural resources and fossil fuels. So you see the advent of fracking. Obviously, we've seen the Keystone Pipeline and the oil within North America coming down from Canada. And now the proposal for offshore drilling on the Pacific and Atlantic coasts. Now, there is pushback there, but there could be a tremendous shift where the United States could become a major exporter of fossil fuels, and that changes the game entirely. That basically
And I think you may see that because of President Trump saying that he wants to even though he's denigrated NATO verbally at times, mm-hmm. he's at the same time argued that he wants to see us strengthen our relationship with places like England and France and Germany. And so, I would say that would be prudent to, let's not let Russia unnecessarily fill a void. I would call that a geopolitical self-inflicted wound if we were to do so.
I agree. Yes. So some other things.
Are you gonna live?
I am gonna live. I don't know what the hell
for
happened.
God's sake, man!
Just hacking into everybody's
Jesus,
everybody's ears here. I apologize. Some other
we're
things.
Put you down.
There we go. Put him down. Put him down.
Come here, old yeller.
There's some other things that he brings up. Not too soon. That's a horrific. I don't know if that's a tale of responsibility or just hard lessons. I don't know.
Oh, dude, that's brutal. I mean, I'm not a dog person. I refuse to watch that movie, and I wept as a child.
Like, man, like that was a rough. He shot the dog.
Virtually everybody in my family are cat people, and still, like, I know.
Man, what's the lesson? What's the lesson to be learned here? The lesson to be learned is
put him out of his misery. He had rabies.
Do the right thing. Take a beating and then get shot in the head. Ah, okay.
Well, I mean, I guess I would say that's what you get for being born a dog, but anyway.
So there's other things.
I'm mean spirited.
Alluded to. I'll go over some of the chapters here and people can pick it up. But,
Nate.
So we've got. So some of these chapters here, the chapter two, the U.S. jihadist war, Russia 2020, the rematch, which we just sort of alluded to there. Talking about Russia's vie for dominance again.
He's not going to live forever.
He's not going to live forever. And again, when you're talking about what is their biggest economic gain, economic strong hand suit.
Apparently, Gorbachev's going to live forever.
Allegedly, right? He's on, what do they call
it? He's still around.
Yeah. He'll outlive. So the next chapter 7, American Power and the Crisis of 2030. So,
have we received a check from Stratfor?
Not yet. I mean, we should send
an email over. We should be like, hey, George, buddy.
Hey. So again, he also alludes to in this book, preparing for war again. And I don't think it would take a huge genius to believe that we will be in some sort of conflict again, because we tend to do it every decade or other, every
seven we're currently in.
Every other decade.
You mean like a massive war?
A massive war, yes. So that is
I mean, we're currently in seven armed conflicts, declared or undeclared.
Yeah. So we I'm gonna lose my pen here.
You're losing your bedpan.
Losing my so the in this would be let me see here. The war in the mid-21st century will have classic origins. One country, the United States, will place tremendous pressure on a coalition of two other countries. The United States will not intend to go to war or even to seriously damage Japan or Turkey. It simply will want these two countries to change their behavior. The Japanese and Turks, to the contrary, will feel that the United States is trying to destroy them. They also will not want war, but fear will compel them to act. They will try to negotiate with the United States, but while the Americans will view their own demands as modest, the Turks and Japanese will see them as existential threats. So he's obviously makes the...
He got these after leaving a Chinese buffet, like, you know, your neighbor will not return your lawnmower.
It's a...
Japan and Turkey?
Yeah. No, you got to read the book to build up to that.
I did read the damn book.
Yeah. And, well, I know,
you judge
I
me?
I know you did. But it's very interesting to see where he builds up to that, and I'm not going to spoiler alert it, but it's interesting to see, hey, over the next 50 years, based on geopolitics, why do we pick these two countries? Why Japan and Turkey? And of course, you make these arguments, and you can see the groundwork being set for these predictions now.
He's obviously counting on not the decline of, but the slowdown of China.
So a bit, and he makes the case also in another chapter about China, and we've talked about this on the podcast quite a bit, but the disconnect between rural and urban China, and how that really doesn't create a great fabric for unity, and just the lack of unity within China alone. I mean, it's only being held together by control of power by the government, and just loosely because of economic centers in China. So you can read the book and see why you would find that China doesn't really have this sort of vie for dominance that other countries do. But you see the groundwork being laid in Turkey today. Now, it isn't as secular as he predicted in this book right now, but again, Turkey has been, or what was the region of Turkey over, you know, thousands of years, has been an epicenter because of its place geographically. So he still makes the claim that it will be a power there and a dominant center there, but he made the case because of more of secularism, and I think there's a bit of a shift from that in Turkey right now, but it doesn't mean that it won't continue to progress that way. And then Japan as well, with their resurgence of economics and their fiscal policy there. You've got to think between China and Japan, what, I mean, you can say Japan, China really has this leg up because of exports and manufacturing, but when it comes to a solid, viable economy, who are you going to look to, Japan or China? And I think he makes the case that Japan really has this better foundation and military foundation and infrastructure foundation that China does not. again, it's not going to give it all away, and it's basically impossible to do. But again, the macro perspective and looking at things and taking a bird's eye view, looking at the world and seeing how the chess pieces are being moved, can give you a little bit more indication as to, or a bit of, what's the word I'm looking for? Insight.
Prom night in the Palin household.
Oh, why was
just a tease.
Good Lord. I like it though.
You're welcome.
Where'd you come up with that?
I don't want to know. In the recesses of my
filthy
have inherited the earth, and I'm afraid to impugn myself. But anyway, continue. Sorry.
No.
Prom night at the Palins. You're welcome.
Yes, gives you some insight as to you know what and why leaders are doing certain things. again, we can keep going down this book. I'll leave the later chapters to you to read, because they are...
I don't think your voice is going to make it.
I don't think so either. I don't know what's going on.
You need some bourbon.
Oh, man, it'll scratch it all up.
What?
Maybe not.
It's Granny's method.
That's the grandma's medicine.
Dude, shot of bourbon, I mean, come on, it's good for you.
A little pickleback. No, that's a whiskey, right? Pickleback shot? Pickle juice?
Dude, we don't...
I'm not in college anymore, man. I can't do it.
Well,
so the end of the book, so he's talking about 2050 and on. He begins to talk about Mexico and its resurgence as a massive international player, and then how that creates maybe a bit of awkwardness with those people that still feel an affinity to their homeland in Mexico and Latin America, but are living in the United States. And I'll save that because I think that's just an interesting topic in itself, but how you can see a break or like this cognitive dissonance that would go on in someone's head that has an affinity to another country. And we've seen that before in other wars, and obviously beyond what an individual may feel. They may feel very patriotic to the United States, but because...
I've seen it whenever the World Cup is on in this country.
Sure, but think about someone who is inherently patriotic to the United States, but is from a place like Mexico. So it becomes very easy to point fingers at somebody because of the way they look and the language they may speak. So it becomes, you know, there may be some foundational play for some awkwardness several decades down the road.
You know, you and I both have blue eyes, right?
I have green eyes.
Well, okay, close enough. But you're from Germany, and well, a good bit of your gene pool is mine's from, you know, France
and Scandinavia, yeah.
Yeah, I mean France and England here, but I mean mostly France, some intro, but we'll say France and Germany, and we don't necessarily see eye to eye on a whole lot, but maybe that's, I mean, neither here nor there, but I mean, I see what you're getting at. All you have to do is put on the World Cup here, and even natural-born American citizens that have ties to Mexico, they're not waving American flags, they're waving Mexican flags.
No, and I don't blame them. Go for it. And this year?
Well, I mean, I kind of do. You're from here.
This year, it doesn't matter. Wave the flag for whoever you want.
Well, 2014, Mexico went to the World Cup because the U.S. beat Panama by a two-goal differential that they needed.
Very
Mexico
true.
Wouldn't even gone. Think about that. But anyway, most people are saying they're going to go for a country of their heritage. Let's go around anyway. And you know what? Let's go for Antarctica.
Antarctica, I'm right there with you. So
Iceland, I mean, dude, you got that's a Cinderella. It's the size of the city of Birmingham.
I know. I don't know. I've been picked yet, but we will have more World Cup as it arrives.
I'm hoping you're going for Germany.
Dude, I want to, but here's the thing.
I'm going for France, so.
They're powerhouses every year. So I know my last name
is America.
Velan, you're very right. I think I've made my decision.
Wait, so, I mean, come on, dude. No. I mean, Germany was not a powerhouse not that long ago.
I know. It's very true.
Your Klinsmann came along.
Very true. Very true. So, well, I do I do implore everyone to go and pick up this book. It's a good read. It's one that I've picked up a couple times, and I've got notes and stuff written all over it because it's a deep read. Don't think you're going to bomb through it and remember all of it, but the look, I mean, it really gives you good insight into geopolitics and the things we talk about on this podcast and why we talk about them. And I think if you do like what we talk about, you'll find this book or the next decade very fascinating. And I think you'll enjoy it. Anyway, we're up to a half hour, my friend.
And I don't think your voice is going to make it.
It is not. So we'll be back next week. Starting
back
a little
Monday.
Bit. Yep, on Monday, we'll be doing this next week, starting a little bit of our series, working towards the 2018 midterms. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I'm going to go rest my very voice. So with that, my friend.
Yeah.
We'll see you.